Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm really excited to have you tune into our show again. We are going to talk about something that is big and broad and fun, but it's prompted by the release of a movie on DVD that's coming out the day that we'll release this podcast, April 17th. And it's the film called Clean Flicks, and it's a documentary film by Josh Legare and Andrew James. And it covers a saga that sort of this unique moment in Utah cultural history, maybe you could call it broader Mormon cultural history, about the phenomenon of editing Hollywood movies to cut out the sex, cut out the violence, cut out all those things that probably were the reasons that the film got an R rating to begin with, even though to me, I don't know how Kill Bill could you know, taking care of those things, you know, whatever, make it and quite a few others less than rated R. But it's an interesting case study in a culture and a religion that processes different goals and guidelines in different ways. And we've got the filmmakers with us tonight. We've got Richard Dutcher with us tonight. We've got Brent Beale, who's a great observer of Mormonism, with us tonight. And we're just going to have a great far-ranging discussion about it. But let me just turn the time over to Josh Legare. I think he's the most familiar to the Mormon Matters audience, at least of the two filmmakers. I know Richard Dutcher will be very familiar to a lot of you. But Josh, would you tell everybody your handle on these Facebook groups and things like that? And then just if you briefly introduce yourself, that'd be great.
Yeah, the Mormon Stories family might know me as Icarus Arts. That's the name of my production company, is Icarus Arts and Entertainment. And so my Facebook page is Icarus Arts. And I spend a lot of time on the Mormon Stories Facebook community. So you've probably seen me chiming in there from time to time. But I'm a lifelong Mormon, I guess you could say. I was interested in your Pacific Islander podcast you did a few weeks ago,
yeah,
Dan.
Because you're Fijian, right?
Yeah, I'm Fijian, exactly. I'm kind of a product of BYU Hawaii and the Polynesian Cultural Center. So my dad was a dancer at the PCC, and my mom was a blue-eyed, blonde-haired little girl from Idaho that came out to Hawaii and got romanced by an islander. So anyway, I kind of grew up all over the Western United States and landed in Utah and had been working in the film industry for about 10 years now, I guess, just kind of trying to figure out how to break in and work my way up. And after, it took me quite a while before I realized there wasn't a way to kind of work your way up to directing. You just had to do it. So started directing commercials and documentaries and music videos, and eventually hooked up with Andrew, and we made this film. And yeah, and I'm still doing documentary and reality television now for the National Geographic Channel. But
oh, very cool. Hey, and I know you're involved with one other product that I think sort of this podcast type community would do, and that would be the This Divided State. Can you tell us about your role in that and what that film was about?
Yeah, when I was attending Utah Valley University, which was UVSC at the time, you know, there was a controversial visit of Michael Moore to campus during the 2000 election, and a lot of people in the community were upset about it, and the response was to invite Sean Hannity to kind of rebut Michael Moore's statements. And so being a student at the time, I just picked up a camera and started filming. And I was already working on film crews at the time as well. But I started noticing other students around the school who were also filming. And we decided to kind of band together and make a movie with all of our combined footage. There was another student named Steve Greenstreet who was attending BYU at the time. And he was also there. And so he kind of wanted to get in on the action. And we all put our footage together. And Steve ended up getting the director credit, but that was a point of contention, I guess, among the rest of us. But
I didn't mean to bring that up for that. I actually didn't know that. I knew that Steve's name was the most associated, but I had known that you'd been a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a good learning experience, and I, you know, it was a student film by a lot of measures, but it was an interesting cultural moment in Utah, and I was glad that we could help capture it.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for being on. And your partner here, Andrew James, would you tell us about you?
Yeah, sure. So I guess in the way of disclosure, I should probably say that I no longer attend church, but I'm also mostly lifelong Mormon. My entire family is Mormon, so I have that background, which kind of helped inform some of the decisions we made on the film. And I'm a documentary filmmaker, I guess, sort of focusing on documentaries right now. I've got a new project in the works. I live in Salt Lake City, did Clean Flicks with Josh for 3 years, graduated from BYU, and just excited to be on.
Very good. Well, it's great to have you, and I'm sure we'll get to know you, and parts of your story will come out a little bit as you share some things. Richard Dutcher, welcome to the One and Only True podcast. We had you on Mormon Stories, but now you've kind of moved up to one higher degree of glory.
Thank you, Dan.
So, thanks for being on. I know you're feeling lousy tonight, so we really appreciate you coming on with some kind of virus that's making you there. But you were a part of this film as far as a talking head. But just give us a broader thing, and then also please feel free to tell us about current projects that you're working on as well as, you know, do your past stuff.
Yeah, well, for those who don't know me, I'm a filmmaker, writer, director, producer, and sometimes actor, and made the films God's Army. God's Army was my first LDS audience film, or LDS-themed film, I guess I should say, and then Brigham City and States of Grace and Falling, which was, I suppose you'd say, was my final LDS-themed film, and that opens the 27th, a week from Friday, so the 27th of April, downtown Salt Lake City at the Broadway Center. We're going to do a big premiere, and then just kind of launch the film and hopefully travel around to some different art houses in different cities. Depends on how our film does in Salt Lake City, so I'm sure hoping that it does.
Right.
As well.
So if you're in the greater Utah northern half of the state or even going to visit, please definitely do that, because every seat sold counts, doesn't it, Richard, when it comes to keeping it there and
yeah, exactly.
Getting it in other places. Yeah,
right.
Cool. So I know you're doing that, and then I know you're going to start filming another, I guess it's a feature-length film in early May, right?
Yeah, right. I've got a horror film called Evil Angel that I've still got to get out.
Oh, right, for sure.
And so that's just a good mainstream, fun horror movie. And then I start shooting on May 6th. I start shooting a film called The Boys at the Bar, which is just a fun comedy set in St. Louis.
Great. Well, good luck on all that, and thanks for joining us. And we'll kind of go to you early on in case your strength's better at the beginning of the podcast than later. So thanks. Hey, Brent Veal, welcome back to the podcast. Is this third time?
I think it is.
Yeah, I know we had you on immigration, and I'm trying to remember what the other one was. I'm not very good at
testimonies.
Yes, a lot of people related to you on that one. So Brent, tell us a little bit about your background.
Okay, my name is Brent Beal. Pretty conventional Mormon upbringing. Grew up in Washington State. Served a mission in Spain. Graduated from BYU in the early 90s, 1992, I think. My wife and I left. Headed off to graduate school.
And our listeners will know your wife is Heather Olson Beal.
Yes.
And she's been on the podcast three or four times probably.
She has as well. I'm a business professor now at the University of Texas at Tyler. My area is strategic management. I've done some work in the intellectual property area from a strategic management perspective. And I blog at Doves and Serpents. My wife got me into that, Heather. I do a series there called A Mormon in the Cheap Seats.
Right. Very good series. Yep. Very popular. I mean, lots of comments always on those things. So
great.
Appreciate having you. You're just a great observer. Who was trying to jump in there?
I just want to say it was great. I enjoy his blogs very much.
Cool. Thanks, Josh. Hey, before I have you guys just introduce the story of the events that the film covers and stuff like that, would you give yours take this chance to tell people how to get it when it releases tomorrow, or well, it'll be today by the time people will hear this podcast?
Sure. I mean, the film is already available on iTunes and Amazon, and then we've got a DVD release that's scheduled for today, but looks we're having some technical issues, so it might get pushed a few days, but it's getting released any day now, and so you can order the DVD right now on our website, which is cleanflixthemovie.com.
Okay, and spell the clean flicks.
It's like Netflix, clean flicks, C-L, yeah, E-A-N-F-L-I-X.com, cleanflixthemovie.com.
Great, great. Hey, well, I'll just turn the time over to you two. You guys divide it up however you'd like to, you know, tell us about when this story started in terms of, you know, the events in Utah, when you guys got involved with deciding that it would make an interesting subject, and just kind of give us the arc of the basic story, and then with that sort of in our background, we'll kind of dive into the topics that it raises. So
sure. A lot of people will probably be familiar with the Clean Flicks story in general, but for those who aren't, there was a company that sprouted up in the around 2000, and they were editing Titanic. You know, that film was a PG-13 film that a lot of people went to see, and we're seeing a lot of people are going back to see it right now in 3D. But, you know, it had the infamous Kate Winslet breast shot, and, you know, that didn't really appeal to a lot of the viewers in Utah County. And so a very savvy businessman named Ray Lyons decided he was going to start snipping those naughty bits out of films. And he got the idea really from the Varsity Theater. And the Varsity Theater, as people who went to BYU will know, has been editing films for years, and they continue to do it in their international cinema program. But they got in trouble from Hollywood, kind of mostly to do with editing Schindler's List. And so when the Varsity got shut down for the first time, that was right around the time Clean Flicks popped up on the scene. And they were editing VHS tapes by hand, just taking the tape out and splicing it together, you know, with scissors and scotch tape. And it became a pretty profitable business, and they chugged along for a few years. But when The Matrix came out, that was really the film that actually launched them into a whole new realm of success, because it also kind of coincided with DVD. And so they were able to start doing things digitally, and their business just took off, and they had 80 locations around the United States. They branched out outside of Utah. But it was mostly popular, you know, within Utah County, as many of us could imagine. And yeah, they were moving online. They were moving toward kiosks and like Redbox style kiosks.
Oh, interesting.
Until they were shut down due to a lawsuit with the Directors Guild of America. And actually, it was a Clean Flicks dealer in Colorado who sued the DGA first, hoping to keep the case out of California courts and keep it in his home state of Colorado. He actually filed the lawsuit, but he felt as though he had been guided by God to, you know, file this lawsuit. And so he did what he did, and Clean Flicks corporate wasn't too happy with him. And eventually they lost, and the judge ruled that what they were doing was illegal. And not just Clean Flicks, but a lot of other companies that were doing very similar stuff, if not the exact same thing. Right. Only Clearplay, which is a company that, rather than editing the movie and making an alternate copy of the disc, Clearplay actually gives you a USB drive that's essentially a glorified remote control that skips and mutes its offensive content via the DVD player device itself. So they're not making a new copy, so they were allowed to stay in business, according to the judge's ruling. As I understand it, maybe Brent can give us more insight into that. But our film really kind of picks up, at least our filming picked up, when we found out that many of the stores in Utah were staying open illegally, kind of under the radar. And so that was what really sparked our interest, and we started following that story of these store owners, you know, these LDS guys who were supposedly doing this for, you know, to support or promote family values, but they were knowingly kind of breaking the law. And that, to us, raised a lot of questions about morality, and it raised a lot of questions about, you know, who exactly these people were, and you know, what morality they valued over, you know, was it the law of the land, or was it their understanding of God's law? And so we decided to kind of investigate that further and see what we could find.
The divine right to watch R-rated movies. God's law.
Yeah, right. So. No, for cool. real. For real.
Yeah, Andrew, jump in a little bit and just kind of do a little bit more than Josh did in terms of the rise and fall. So this began in 2000 with Ray Lyons and, you know, editing Titanic and things like that. its heyday was what years, and then when did the court ruling come, and then I also want you to just take us a little bit into one of the major characters, Daniel Thompson.
Sure.
And at least mention that he's part of your film and a little bit about his art.
I was actually attending BYU. I graduated in 2007. I was at BYU during the Clean Flicks heyday, and I was living in King Henry, which is like where it's sort of like a hub. Tons of kids there, and everybody was watching movies from Clean Flicks. I would say the heyday was probably 2002 to 2005 or 2006, and the lawsuit actually, they made a decision in 2006. But yeah, like Josh said, The Matrix was huge. I mean, I saw The Matrix the first time on a Clean Flicks disc, and I saw Saving Private Ryan that way, and Traffic, and at the time, I sort of felt like the quality was really poor, and I would always like argue about it with my friends, like, why would we get the Clean Flicks version? Like, this looks horrible, like, it's confusing. But everywhere I went, people were going to Clean Flicks, and there was a store, like, right around the corner from us, just south of campus, and people would just, it was constantly busy, and it was sort of like, just part of the whole like Mormon cultural zeitgeist at the time. Everybody was just into Clean Flicks. It was like a big deal. And I got interested in the project when they got shut down. One of my friends and I, Xavier, were talking one day about how it'd be a cool idea to make a documentary about Clean Flicks. And so we started coming up with ideas, and then Xavier's like, hey, I know this guy named Josh, and he's a filmmaker. You guys should connect or whatever. And so Josh and I met over lunch and decided to just jump right into the project, and we started filming a couple of months after the lawsuit went down. And so so the whole first section of the film is stuff that we sort of went back and recreated with archival material, animations, interviews, and sort of told the story posthumously about the rise and fall of the clean film movement. You know, of course, like Josh said, it started with Titanic and ended with this lawsuit, and there's a lot of interesting things that happened along the way, and it raised a lot of questions about marketing morality and these sort of contradictory stances on what's right and what's wrong and how all that interplays with media and film and art and the role of the consumer, and all that stuff sort of gets explored through that story. And then, as Josh mentioned, we started following these guys that were staying open illegally after the lawsuit, and the prominent one that we had access to was this guy, Daniel Thompson, who you mentioned. And basically, he was just the most willing to be on camera. And at first, we weren't sure if he was going to stay open or not. And he was sort of telling us, hey, there's all these other stores that are staying open, and you should go check it out. And so we were kind of going to him for information at first, not really realizing that he was going to become like a central character in the film. But he was so willing to give us information and to talk to us about what was going on and sort of pointed us in all these different directions. Like, hey, these guys are still open. These guys are still open. And so Josh and I would follow up on those and start doing our own research and our own investigative reporting, if you will. And it led us down all kinds of interesting different paths, some of which aren't even included in the film. We were really like sneaking into stores and trying to get shots. And everyone was really, really afraid to talk to us. And I think that's because they knew that there was a chance that they could get in trouble. And Daniel, for some reason or another, was just totally fine giving us all this information. And then surprisingly, a few months after we started filming, he came back into business, and it kind of went from there. And I think a lot of people know the story of Daniel. He had this store, Flicks Club. It was in business for like a year and a half, 2 years after Clean Flicks was shut down in 2006, and then eventually got arrested.
Andrew. No. Don't.
Spoiler.
No spoilers.
Okay. So
let's just say that something really fascinating happens.
Right.
Richard, thank you for, you always have your director's hat on, you're directing the podcast. Sup! Anyway, no, I appreciate that. We'll have you guys sell more DVDs by not going any further on Daniel. There's one piece in the story just to make sure, because most people, you know, you see that federal warning at the beginning of every, you know,
right,
film that you rent and stuff like that. And the reason that Ray Lines and his partners thought that they could do this was because of this buy one, edit one kind of thing. Do you guys want to quickly tell them that piece, or maybe Brent?
It's a fascinating kind of, and I... Just full disclosure here, I'm not a lawyer. I mean, I'm coming at this from a business perspective. But in copyright law, there is this doctrine of first sale. And I believe that's what you're referring to, this idea that
right.
that if you buy a book, for example, as long as, you know, if I buy a copy of that book, even though I've now got the intellectual property that's embedded in this physical wrapper, right, I can do whatever I want to that book. I can cut pages out. I can go sell the book to my neighbor. I can rent it if I want. And whoever owns that copyright, their control doesn't extend to that physical copy of the book that I've purchased. So there's kind of a wall there, and that's the doctrine of first sale. And that, I believe that was the defense that CleanFlix used defend what they were doing. Because, you know, they purchased the DVDs. I mean, they purchased them and then they altered them and then rented them out. So they felt that they were only altering their property in a sense.
Well, also they were buying an original for every copy they produced, or so they claim. And that,
right.
I mean, not everybody was doing that according to our research, but some people definitely were. And they argued that the one-to-one ratio, i.e. buying an original for each copy they produced, made it so that Hollywood wasn't losing any profit and that made it, you know, fair use or whatever. They also argued fair use in the lawsuit, which the judge completely threw out the window. And one of the things that we discovered in the process is that when you actually buy a DVD, like, you're not actually buying a copy of it. You're like purchasing the right to view it. I think the copyright law as it pertains to films is a little bit different. And when you you're buying a derivative copy of a work that actually exists in a vault somewhere, like in a studio in Los Angeles. And so you don't mm-hmm. actually own the film, like you own this copy of the film. And the judge came down in the lawsuit and said that making a derivative copy, even if you buy an original for each copy that you produce, is what's at stake here. It's like, it's not the editing, it's not the artistic integrity of the filmmaker, it's the fact that you're making a copy and selling that copy.
Right, right. And what they were trying to do, as far and maybe, you know, just to clarify, somehow I think by saying, okay, we're purchasing as many copies here as we're editing or we're selling, basically they were trying to hide behind this idea of first sale. Well, technically they were copying, right, because they didn't want to edit every single DVD that they got a hold of. So there had to be some copying going on behind the scenes. But as long as they had purchased as many copies as ultimately they were then sending out to these stores, then they could make the claim that, look, you know, we this is the DVD, the actual physical DVD is our property, and that's what we're altering, so, you know, we can get by with this. Which ultimately, like you're saying, I mean, it didn't hold water.
Well, and they tried a lot of different methods. One, you know, after a while, they realized their overhead was too high to actually keep all those original DVDs in stock. So they started telling clients, well, you have to own the original, and then you have to sign a paper that says you own the original, and then we'll sell you the edited version. And then another company was wording it as though this edited version is your backup copy. So you have the original, but this is your edited backup copy, you know. And so they tried a lot of ways to get around
that
law. They did. And just I mean, I'm sure you're aware. I think the case was Huntsman v. Soderbergh, I believe.
Yes.
And it did go CleanFlix's way. But there are a lot of people who feel that perhaps it should have, that this was a little bit of an overreach, that this, you know, does kind of go beyond the first sale doctrine, and in this case the directors of the studios were kind of able to exert some control over a physical copy of an intellectual piece of intellectual property that had been purchased. And so I mean, I'm just pointing out that there are
right, and that's where I want to take us right now, Richard. I want to make sure that we get you in here, and I know Josh and Andrew, as filmmakers, you'll have lots of opinions too. Richard, you in the film, you were able to give voice to the Steven Soderberghs and the Spielbergs and all the people that, you know, these, it wasn't 16 directors that were sort of named. So this Directors Guild of America group, you were able to give voice to, you know, yeah, they're making lots of money on these films that are getting sold. You know, they're you know, there's no problem that their CleanFlix is a great customer of, you know, helping the bottom line of their films. But they were, you know, they were really pissed about the artistic integrity of the product being altered because of, well, why don't you go ahead and just kind of give voice fresh for that, if you don't mind.
Well, sure. As I said in the film, you know, as a filmmaker, you labor over everything, you know, you labor over every word, you labor over every shot, and you make very considered decisions about every element of your film. And so there's something just, basically, there's something you feel trespassed upon when someone you don't know in the back room of a video store in Spanish Fork, Utah, is just making decisions on what should and should not be in your film. And so that was one thing that, I never felt good about that. I was also here I was living in Utah at that time. And I was not, I refused to watch. I refused to watch anything, that came out of CleanFlix or any of those companies. In fact, I used to joke about passing by the stores, and my boys would be in the car, and we'd joke about mooning the store as we drove by, and saying edit that. And,
cool. And, thanks for sharing, Richard.
We also joked about, it's like, that was my favorite part of the movie Titanic was the Kate Winslet shots, and so wanted to get my hands on the vault of wherever that, all that footage was being kept so that I could just make an eternal loop of Kate Winslet, showing her breath. So.
Too funny. Hey, it just dawned on me, Richard, I hadn't thought about this before the call. Did they happen to make any edits to any of your films in their stores, like the infamous bathroom scene in God's Army or anything?
No, as I understand it, I was speaking with one of the owners of one of the stores, and he said that the LDS genre films were kind of sacred, and they decided they wouldn't touch those.
Oh, they're artistic. The artistic achievement of the singles ward couldn't be messed with, but Schindler's List could.
Right.
So as I know, the LDS films were never tampered with.
Interesting. That would have been, that's too funny. Anyway, but go ahead. Is there any more that you wanted to say just sort of about, speaking for the directors or just that how you, you'd feel?
I mean, the issue for me that riled me up the most was this idea of my morality trumps your morality. So the idea that, the fact that certain people don't believe that certain words or certain images shouldn't be shown. And even though it violates the law for them to go in and make those changes, they felt justified in doing that. And for me, that just, I found that really fascinating. The fact that, they were able to excuse, breaking the laws of the land, which are, part of the, LDS belief system. They were able to excuse that because they believed that they were acting according to a higher law. And so I found that, fascinating and annoying.
But there is something to be said for that idea of censorship. I mean, I think that is what the filmmakers are reacting against, that idea. I mean, there are, there are different powers at work here. The studios are watching out for their copyrighted material, making sure that they're making every cent they can on their product. The filmmakers are really concerned about their art, and I think that's where I find editing to be the most troubling, because I don't necessarily have a problem with someone doing what they want with their own property. But when you start talking about censorship, then I start feeling more and more uncomfortable.
Right. But now there is one small piece here. The Directors Guild folks at least let their movies be edited to show on airplanes and things.
Right.
So
there's that little area where, you're not being consistent to yourself there. But
that's the excuse that I've heard so many times, and it irritates the hell out of me because, but again, yes, the studios do have edits of their films to play on the airlines, but they are they have control over those cuts. Sometimes the director himself will go in and make the cuts, and other times the studio will do it. But regardless, those who own the copyrights for the films are the ones making the changes, and I don't have any problem with that.
Right. Okay. Good. All right. Now, one thing that you said, Richard, that might be interesting is as you kind of led into that, my morality, your morality, and breaking the law. Would you say, and this maybe the filmmakers can speak to it because they met with Ray Lines and stuff more than these other guys, would you say that they knew or really suspected that it was illegal what they were doing prior to the court ruling? Or do they truly have confidence that this one-to-one first, what'd you call it, Brent, first sale?
First sale doctrine.
Yeah, first sale doctrine. Were they confident that they were on solid legal ground, and it's only after the court ruling and then this Flix Club and all that came on that you really get into that area of, knowing that you're operating under a big cloud?
Well, I think it varies. I mean, I'm sure some of them went about it. You know, I'm willing to give that, you know, that some of them, you know, felt that they were doing the right thing right up until, and even after the ruling came down against them, you know, but at that point, I mean, some of them did stop, you know, it wasn't like they all continued. And so I think it's kind of problematic to lump them all into, because I think there were, as I think the movie itself shows, there were some who were in it with, I think, very good intentions, if wrong-headed, you know, good but wrong-headed intentions. Right. And there were others who were in it, you know, to make money and were going to take it as far as they could.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
So, yeah. Andrew, do you want to speak anything more to Ray Lyons? Do you think he suspected that he was doing anything wrong until the court ruling?
I mean, I don't want to like place a judgment on him. I feel like Ray is a like pretty bombastic guy and very opinionated and sometimes puts his foot in his mouth, or did put his foot in his mouth. But I kind of got the sense from him that he truly believed in what he was doing. And I don't want to vilify him or whatever.
I thought he came across quite likable and credible.
Yeah, and he was a great interview, and I'm glad he let us in. And you know, we wouldn't have a film without him. So I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh yeah, he knew he was breaking the law. You know, you can speculate maybe a part of him thought, you know, maybe this is illegal, but obviously he believed very strongly in what he's doing and felt like he was providing a service that the community wanted.
I will say that his business partner, Alan Erb, is an attorney, and they felt, once at least Alan got involved with it, I think they thought they were on pretty solid legal ground. I think they had planned to appeal, as he says in the film, but because the judge's ruling was so harsh, they didn't have the opportunity to appeal. But they really were planning on carrying out the appeals process.
Okay, cool. All right, well, let's dive full into this whole mindset that, you know, probably has deep roots in Mormonism, and as well as, you know, all over the world when there's a group that says society's going to hell in a handbasket. You know, we need to keep ourselves somewhat distant from the world, and yet human nature kind of wants to be part of the world, and so you start doing things in your head to say what's ethical, what's not ethical, or you know, again, the God's laws versus human laws kind of stuff. So what's a good entry point into that discussion? Richard kind of got us started there. Did somebody want to jump in right on the tail of his and go with it?
I think really it's just like we kind of hint at in the film. I think it's just because of President Benson and that talk that he gave about R-rated films.
Tell us the year on that and
it was 1986, and it was actually during priesthood session that President Benson made that remark about avoiding R-rated movies and
The young men as well.
Right, to the young men only. The R-rated sort of taboo has never been mentioned during the main general conference at the pulpit.
Right,
it's been mentioned a lot, like in The Ensign and the Strength for Youth pamphlet, and also like the film shows in 1986 at priesthood session. Although we don't make that distinction because it's just sort of nuts and bolts that would be boring.
Right.
But I think that has a lot to do with it. And I think that there's sort of like a cultural fear that this material that is R-rated is going to get in and it's going to like pervert the viewers. Kind of like Phil says in the film that, you know, if you watch this material, it's going to influence you in a negative way. And I think that's what people are really afraid of. But at the same time, they want to be entertained and they want to see these great films. And so it's sort of like, well, if we take out the bad stuff, then what's so wrong about watching this movie or whatever? I think people feel guilty about it.
We all know that Mormons, you know, see themselves as the most American Americans. You know, we want to be part of the cultural zeitgeist, and we don't want to be left out of any of it, right? So when there's, you know, a movie like Saving Private Ryan, it, Mormons want to go see it too, and they will go see it if an edited version isn't available. You know, you can go to the movie theater in Utah Valley on any weekend and see the theaters packed full for R-rated films. But I think, you know, there was a certain level of comfort being able to go with the R-rated version. But, you know, there were also people who didn't think the R-rated versions went far enough. We had people that we talked to that
the clean versions. The clean versions.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I say? The R-rated versions?
Yeah,
yeah,
there
were people, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
thanks, Brent.
Yeah, they wanted an NC-17 version. No,
I thought you were going there for a second. I go, wow.
No, I mean they thought the clean versions didn't go far enough, and they didn't want to see. You know, they didn't even want to support Hollywood by buying the original to get the edited version. You know, and there were people who were worried about the souls of the poor people who were editing the movies. You know, and they didn't want to. They didn't want to force that one man to take the fall for the rest of us. So, you know, there's a diversity.
Richard be volunteering.
Let me interject really quick. Let me interject really quick. We had one interview that got cut from the film where it was just like, you know, a girl at BYU who's like, who's the pervert in the back room editing all the R-rated movies? You know, I think that's an idea that we kind of ran across a lot.
that's true sacrifice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
Put your own spirituality on the line for the group.
At the end, it was a lot of University of Utah State University students up there, film students up there doing the editing.
That's,
so.
That's right, because, yeah, kind of the second loophole that at least this Daniel Thompson thought he was because this one company was sort of, we have an education loophole or something, and it was based in Logan, right?
Right, exactly. They would just get some film students down from Utah State to come and do the edits over the weekend.
So. Find somebody that could, you know, handle Kate Winslet's breasts, I guess, and survive.
Yeah. Interesting right. Choice of words there, Brent. Thank you. Anyway.
Come out unscathed.
That's right.
Dan, can I just point Please. Out one thing here I think is kind of ironic, as long as we're talking about Hollywood and the evils of the world and everything else. It always kind of struck me as ironic that you know, there is this reaction, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, Hollywood has no morals, et cetera, et cetera. So I've often thought that it's pretty interesting that the rating system that we use, that's supposedly a reflection of our values, is the Hollywood rating system. That seems ironic to me. These guys, they don't know anything about morals. They don't understand what's going on. They produce this filth. Let's use their rating system to figure out what we want to watch.
That's definitely one perspective. I would say that a lot of the filmmakers and studios see the ratings board as being a super conservative group. It's comprised of like moms and dads and like regular people, like the MPAA. And there's a great film about it called This Film Is Not Yet Rated.
I was just going to mention that. Right? That is a great film. Yes.
That it kind of exposes like the conservative nature of the MPAA. Perhaps not conservative enough for mainstream Mormon audiences, but I think a lot of people in Hollywood see the MPAA as sort of like their nemesis.
I think that's true, and I wouldn't argue that it's so much of a level of, you know, whether these folks are more or less conservative. I just see it as an interesting case of outsourcing. You know, if we're so concerned about our values and you know, we're different and distinct from the world, well, why don't we come up with our own rating system? Or why don't we think about, you know, what our values are and then impose those on these films?
But you've really seen the church move toward. I mean, it's rare for anyone to mention an R rating within, you know, a church talk now. It's within the culture, but you know, the idea is to, you know, avoid things that are inappropriate. And so, of course, being people who avoid Coca-Cola because, you know, coffee is banned, you know, people take that as far as they can possibly take it with, you know, what's deemed inappropriate. But that idea of self-censorship, I notice, is really pervasive in the culture.
It is. And outsourcing the control over exactly what gets censored or not, I think is an interesting pattern there too as well.
See, the R-rating thing wouldn't even make sense outside of the United States. I mean, so many, if you know, the majority of Mormons are outside of the United States where there's no such thing as an R-rating, it's really kind of a dumb standard to follow in the first place.
You know, I often wonder if the, the churches, like Josh mentioned, like moved away from talking about the R rating specifically in recent years. But I wonder if they're hoping, this is just me speculating, there's nothing to back this up, but I'm wondering if they're hoping that like the church membership will sort of say, oh, well, if that's inappropriate in an R-rated film, it's probably inappropriate in a PG or PG-13 movie as well. I'm wondering if they're hoping to cast a broader net over the media that we shouldn't be watching as members of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was kind of alluding to that ineloquently when I was, you know, alluding to the, you know, the Coke thing, because I think that is the idea. I think, you know, we want to censor ourselves as much as possible. And people are afraid to kind of make choices on their own. We did interview one LDS representative in the church. He was a media representative for Utah County. So although for a national audience, that might have been interesting, it probably wouldn't have held much water with LDS audiences. And it just didn't make sense to include ultimately. But he had an interesting take. You know, he was also a professor at BYU, and he was really upset with what he saw as a lack of interest in his students in making their own choices. They wanted a rule to follow rather than to exercise their own agency.
Good. And that's an angle. That's an angle to go after.
I think if Dan wants to let us, we could talk about that for a few minutes.
Yeah, do. Go for it.
It just seems like the culture was so set up for this kind of business model that, you know, I'm not sure this could have occurred in the same way, in the same way anywhere else in the country. It's just, at least in my experience in Mormonism, there's so much emphasis on this idea that the church, the leadership of the church, is able to see things that we can't see, that they have, or kind of collectively, the church, the institution, has this light and knowledge that they want that we should want to tap into, and that they should want to kind of, you know, push down the hierarchy to us, that we're taught, you know, from primary, I think, that if we want to be happy, you know, if we want our lives to kind of turn out well, then we need to find direction from someone who's, you know, up on a hill, someone that can see farther than we can, someone who's closer to God than we are, so to speak. And it's just kind of ingrained almost in a way. So when a prophet stands up and says, don't see R-rated movies, for a lot of people, you know, there just isn't any there just isn't any debate anymore. There's a beautiful quote in Clean Flicks, the documentary, where you have somebody saying that there is virtue in just being obedient. Just the act of obedience is virtuous, regardless of whether or not what you're being told makes any sense.
Well said. Well said.
Andrew, you and I started to have a little conversation before we got on that you're kind of like Brent, that you think Utah was sort of like the perfect storm for this, and it wouldn't have taken hold as the way it had in any place.
Yeah, I sort of feel like Clean Flicks could only exist like in a Mormon vacuum. And what I mean by that is that it just plays so perfectly, like Brent mentioned, to all the cultural oddities of Mormonism. Because like Josh said earlier, Mormons do see themselves as being all Americans. They want to participate in the cultural zeitgeist. At the same time, there is no debate once the prophet speaks. And Mormons don't like being seen as other. And there's this big push right now in the church with the PR campaign of I'm a Mormon, and with Mitt Romney running for president, it's like Mormons everywhere, and the church is really pushing to like sell Mormons as not being other, but as being like regular everyday Americans. And I think that's very much part of the cultural understanding of Mormons of themselves. They see themselves as being like, hey, we're just like you guys. We're not these weirdos. We don't practice polygamy. You know, we don't, you know, wear bonnets. We don't live like in communal settings together. Like Mormons are, they're capitalists, they're businessmen, they're lawyers. They drive minivans. They've big families. Like they're sort of all American. And I think that in conjunction with the particular set of values that get handed down from the top, from the church hierarchy, it's just a perfect vacuum for Clean Flicks to exist and thrive. Because it plays to all of those things. It allows Mormons to feel like they're normal, but also follow the rules.
Okay, so good. Now, was it you, Brent, that mentioned the professor who says his students didn't want to think for themselves, they wanted to do it?
I brought that up earlier.
Oh, yeah. Was that you, Josh? Okay. Let's give them that. Let's say that's just fine, no R-rated movies, but then they're making this choice. I can see them saying, Schindler's List is something I should see. Passion of the Christ is something that's worth seeing. Kill Bill, Saw, some of the ones that you guys show in the film, you know, you kind of show the unedited version and the Clean Flicks version and things like this. there's some things that are just so out of the realm of things that you would think that no one would think that this little loophole of, well, they've taken out the gore, the exact moment of the blood spurting from the neck, or they've taken out the breasts, you know, or whatever it would be. You know, there would be just no moral universe that it would seem to me that anybody could say, I think Kill Bill is going to be a good movie for me to see, if they have that mindset to even worry about, you know, ordering a clean flicks
version. Well, I think the clean flicks audience isn't one that thinks about context too much. You know, for the meaning of a breast isn't a breast. So, you know, if you're seeing a breast, that's bad. It doesn't matter what the context is. If you're hearing a swear word, this word is bad. It doesn't matter in what context you're seeing that word or hearing that word. And so I think there's not a lot of thought, you know, when it comes to that.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's well said, man. I feel like the clean flicks decontextualizes everything. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's no thought about how those things that are deemed inappropriate affect the story, the narrative, the character development, or how the film plays, or how or the feeling it's supposed to give you. I think a lot of people see a breast on a film or see a violent act in a film and think, oh, they're glorifying sex, they're glorifying violence, when that couldn't be further from the truth, because they have no ability to see those things in context.
Right. Richard, we need to get you out of your drug-induced stupor or whatever, your antihistamines or whatever, and get you to jump back in. What in this last 15 minutes has kind of caught your attention to jump in on?
Oh, no, I'm just fascinated listening to, I mean, Josh and Andrew are the experts here. And by the way, I saw this film shortly after they finished, and it's just an excellent, excellent movie. So I think I just want to jump in right now and encourage everybody to see it. It's a fascinating and well-done documentary, so everybody should jump on that set and order it right away.
Thank you.
But any other thought is like how people react to your films or something that could sort of, you know, give a little more insight into the Mormon mindset when it comes to just thinking or not thinking? And I really think Josh's point about they're not imagining context at all.
Richard, could you tell the story about the opening weekend of States of Grace that you told us? You didn't make it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So this was right in the midst of this. It was 2005, and I was opening States of Grace, which was the somewhat of a sequel to God's Army, called it God's Army 2 in Utah, and put a lot of, you know, work into promoting the film. Had it opened up in several theaters, and it was a disappointing opening weekend. But what was most disappointing was that I have a habit to visit the theaters when the films are playing, and so I showed up at the Cinemark 16, and it was the same weekend that one of the Saw movies was opening. I can't remember which of the multiple, but it was just so discouraging to me to be in the heart of Mormondom in Provo, and to see my theater with, you know, 40 or 50 people at a 7 o'clock show, and to poke my head into the 7 o'clock showing of Saw, and there wasn't a single seat available. You know, so it was. I thought it was very telling.
Maybe Saw was the safer moral choice,
Richard? Yeah, maybe so.
Can I ask Richard a question? This is kind of a, you know, God's Army was, you know, I look back on that. And in fact, when I realized I was going to be doing this podcast tonight, I threw it back into my Netflix queue. I want to see it again. But, I mean, do you mind if I ask you a question about how that was received?
No, sure, go ahead.
I'm just curious if you would just comment on that from the perspective kind of what we've been talking about. I mean, what did you hear? I mean, were people pleased with it? Were they uncomfortable with it? Were people conflicted in a moral sense about some of the content?
A couple of interesting things about that was, because it was somewhat new, you know, it was pretty much the first time that Mormons had seen a story about themselves playing, you know, out in the public and regular movie theater. And I got a question. You know, I would often do Q&As after the film, and the question that I got, it was almost always the first question after we would open it up to questions and answers. And the first, they had just viewed the film, and immediately the first question was usually, how does the church feel about this film? Because they didn't, you know, they didn't.
Very important.
They didn't know how they should feel about it until they were told how they should feel about it. You know, they're very open to the idea of, You know, if the church was okay with it, then they would like it, and if the church wasn't okay with it, then they wouldn't like it. And one interesting experience with that was when we opened, when we did a screening at Jordan Commons in Sandy, Utah, and there was a previous screening, and we had Sister Haight, David B. Haight's wife, was in the audience at that time, and I had always had trouble answering that question when people would say, you know, how does the church feel about it? I would always, it took me a while to know how to answer that question, and it was at that screening when somebody asked me the question, and I said, well, you're the church, how do you feel about it? And then somebody started applauding, and then I looked up, and it was Sister Haight was applauding, you know, to that answer, and I thought, and then it became very clear to me, and it was like, I'm sure she and the leadership of the church get pretty sick of people coming to them, you know, wanting to know if certain music is okay for them to listen to, or if certain movies are okay to watch, or TV shows, and it's trying to abdicate that responsibility.
But that's really interesting. That's really interesting.
That is really interesting.
Yeah.
That's an excellent answer, Richard.
Yeah, seriously, that was great, man.
That was great.
Unfortunately, they don't seem to get sick enough of it because they keep giving specific guidance when they shouldn't.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the other thing I found really fascinating was after, because I would go from city to city, you know, showing the film and answering questions, and I always thought if you, you know, any of you that have seen the film recently might remember what I always thought I was going to get, you know, really hit hard about was there's a scene where there's a missionary who's, you know, dabbling with anti-Mormon literature, and there's a late at night when the young missionary comes to the refrigerator, and the other missionary, you know, says, "What if it's not true? What if the apostles and prophets, they know that it's, you know, they know that it's a lie?" And then he says, "You know, damn them, you know, damn them to hell." And I thought I was just going to get hammered over that, but then I never heard anything. I don't think I, in the, you know, the 100 screenings I did for the film, I don't think anybody ever even mentioned that. All they wanted to talk about was a shot of a missionary sitting on the toilet. That it was, yeah. You know, it was that was the dangerous material in the film. It wasn't.
Well, that
it wasn't
that reminds me of Clean Flicks. That reminds me of the example that Phil makes about a kindergarten cop, where it's inappropriate to say penis. The little kid gets up and says, you know, boys have a penis, girls have a vagina. And that's what gets cut out of Kindergarten Cop, an innocent statement by a child.
Right.
I hope they cut both penis and vagina.
They did.
Okay. I was worried about a double standard there.
One or the other would have been pretty bad.
Yeah, you know, it just dawns on me, just at some point in the podcast I was going to bring it up, I might as well just say here, you guys, when you offer it on the DVD, you're going to offer the unrated version of your film, as well as almost like an edited one, right, where they wouldn't see the original, where there were some breasts explain your choice there. So on the DVD, there are two choices for people.
Yeah, well, when we started taking the film out to film festivals, a really common joke, you know, with the audience was that, is there going to be a Clean Flicks version of Clean Flicks? And we always thought that was really funny as an idea. But as we started thinking about it, you know, from kind of a marketing point of view, we thought, you know, there are a lot of people who would probably be interested in the story that wouldn't watch, you know, an R-rated version. So we did make a clean version, you know, that's on the disc. You still have to buy the original to get the clean version. but you know, we thought that we'd make that available to audiences, because I think the conversations that people can have from the film are more important than necessarily seeing, you know, the breasts or whatever in this. In
Right.
The shots,
you know,
right. There's that one scene from The Weatherman, right?
That's right.
Nicolas Cage thing.
Pretty bad.
You know, because but the interesting thing about that is, you know, yeah, you can avoid the breasts or something, but it shows in the Clean Flick version that you completely miss an entire scene that certainly speaks to that main character's experience.
Yeah. Well, and there are other films where you completely lose the entire meaning of a scene, like the Big Lebowski clip, I think, is an interesting
right.
one, where you can't even tell what happened in the scene once they've cut out what they deem offensive, you know.
And you still have that, yeah, you can't really understand his comment about going to a cash machine as he's walking
right.
away in that scene.
Right.
And later
why,
on,
why Seymour Hoffman's laughing maniacally for no reason.
Right.
The documentary, this film is not yet rated, had the same problem. I mean, they showed a lot of scenes in there that I think that documentary is unrated, or at least I saw the NC-17 version.
Yeah, it's tricky when you're dealing with that content. You know, you need to. We felt we needed to show it, but you know, we've also feel like you know it's okay to give that option, and we're the ones that made those choices. So you know, I feel okay about it.
Can I ask a quick follow up to Richard? I thought that was just such a great comment you made. I'd just like to ask, maybe you know, what is it about the culture that creates that kind of reaction where you would have grown adults who should have enough life experience to be able to judge whether or not they think something is appropriate for themselves. What is it about the church? Is it the doctrine? Is it the culture? What is it that, you know, would produce a room full of people that would basically say, well, we don't know what we think. Let's phone home and see if we can get somebody to tell us what we think.
Wow. Well, I think that, I mean, there's so many things in the doctrines and the practices of the church, the way that we're taught, that play into that. The one, and I think Andrew and Josh can, you know, talk more about that, and they have, you know, made reference to that. The one thing that I had to come to peace with, which was very frustrating at the time, you know, because I had studied film since I was a kid, and to me, film was this magnificent art form, and you know, full of nuance and just full of, you know, beauty and wonder. And so, you know, I was presenting things to my people as and expecting them to receive them, you know, in a somewhat educated and artistically experienced way. What I came to realize, of course, which I should have known from the beginning, is, you know, that as we've already mentioned, you know, Mormons are really, at least we, you know, we're a subset. The American Mormons are very much a subset of the American people, and American people are not necessarily generally deep thinkers with regards to their entertainment. You know, and film as an art form has certainly struggled to mature in our culture, and so, and I think it's had even a harder time in the LDS culture because of the doctrines and the teachings and the attitudes. So. I find that to me, that's the one thing that I struggled with, you know, realizing, oh, okay, I was hoping that they would, you know, have a kind of a graduate school level of, you know, artistic experience. And, you know, they're really, you know, still in kindergarten in a lot of ways.
Well, Richard, like you said in the film, they're not looking for answers. Like, they're not looking to answer questions about the universe. You've got a lot of members of the church who sort of feel like they got it all figured out. They've got the truth. They know what they've got to do to make it back to the celestial kingdom. And so the real emphasis on living in this mortal life, if you will, is about getting back to heaven, and everything else is sort of like, right, an addition. It's not like a big priority. So people aren't like looking for answers. They're not seeking art that's going to teach them anything, because I think it does go back to doctrines, at least for me. And I can't speak for anybody else, but for me, I think the doctrines do encourage people to become sort of insular and to sort of become a tad bit, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, they have all the answers. It's like, we know what we're going to do. We know how we're going to get back to the celestial kingdom. And, you know, I'm not going to jeopardize that by watching this R-rated movie, even if it's got an important message, or even if it's going to teach me something or open my eyes to something that maybe I hadn't thought about before. And the same thing applies to other forms of art. You know, literature, you hear stories about people crossing out the bad parts in books. You hear stories about people being offended by art exhibits at the BYU Museum. I mean, I think people are just sort of like, they don't want to jeopardize the opportunity to get back to the celestial kingdom.
Yeah. I had a really fascinating experience when I moved into my house in Mapleton, Utah. We bought the house from a very active LDS family. And there was a period there where, you know, we had some of our stuff in there before they had all their stuff out. And something that that really stuck with me was we first brought over our paintings, and we had this I believe it was a Bouguereau painting, and had some nudity in it. You know, very, very classical, very, you know, non-exploitive, very, very beautiful. And I walked in, and you know, here was a grown man that had come in to pick some of his own materials, some of his own possessions up, and he had actually taken that painting and turned it so that it faced the wall, you know. And so when I came in, I remember, you know, the strange thing of being kind of offended by that and trying to process that. And it's like, what would make someone, you know, you'd have to be somewhat artistically, maybe immature, or artistically retarded, or I'm not exactly sure the right word to use, but I find that so prevalent in the LDS culture where, you know, there just seems to be a complete lack of, well, not a complete lack, obviously there's you know, there are bright spots of artistic appreciation as well, but I find that just somewhat disturbing and strange.
Richard, I got a story that is even more dramatic than that. I used to work at Benchmark Books, which is, you know, used in rare books, and a customer came in to buy a new copy of Dialogue because it was, he had lent his neighbor the issue that had some provocative Trevor Southey paintings that, you know, that depicted nude males or something, but very artistic and whatnot. And it was, and this is, you know, really a famous issue of Dialogue. Well, guess what? He lends it to his friend, and when his friend gives the magazine back, the covers have been torn off. and it was like a trifold thing. And the neighbor thought he was doing the guy a favor by getting rid of that art for him.
Totally.
So here's the guy coming in to replace his own copy of his journal because of the neighbor. Just like, so this guy turning the face to the wall. That's just, oh man.
They're just such an interesting tension here for me, between this idea, which I actually like. If somebody pinned me down and said, you know, what are you still carrying with you from your Mormon upbringing? I think this idea would be would definitely be something that is still a part of kind of how I view God. This idea that we are agents, that we have agency, that we can think and we can reason, and with that, this idea that we have some responsibility, therefore, because we have that capacity to think and to reason, and that process is important, that expectation is important, and it just seems like there's such a tension between that and all the rule following that goes on, and I've had this discussion with people sometimes in the church, and I'm not even sure they can even see the tension, but to me, those two things are very difficult to reconcile. You know, there's a difference, and I use this analogy, and I've used it a couple times in some of my posts on Doves and Serpents. There's a difference between handing a kid a paint-by-numbers set and telling him to stay in the lines and giving him a blank sheet of paper and asking him to draw something interesting. Which of those two things are parents generally the most pleased by? I mean, if you talk to most parents are probably happier with the creative kind of crazy drawings. They probably wouldn't think much of a paint by the numbers set that had been appropriately completed. Well, for me, I just extend that up to God a little bit. You know, I think God wants us to heft things a little bit and think through things and experience things, and I think He's concerned about the process, about how we do that. And so, I mean. And for me, this is all, this is all related. I mean, the opportunity that CleanFlix exploited really was just, in my mind, just excessive rule following for the purpose, as far as I can see it, for no other real reason other than to follow rules. And I'm sure with
it's
all
lazy
else,
rule following.
It is. And when I was at BYU, it wasn't CleanFlix. When I was at BYU, there were couples that would go to Las Vegas and get married for the weekend.
Right.
So that they could, have sex, and it was guilt-free, right? Because technically they were married, and, they'd get divorced when they came back, because you can do that sort of thing in Vegas. And so that took away the guilt. And you can only get to a place where that's possible if you are so over on the rule-following side that really there is no morality behind it anymore. The rules themselves are the morality.
Totally.
And so if you want to watch Kill Bill and it's edited so that it's within the rules of the game, so to speak, then your path is still open to Celestial Kingdom. There's no guilt, no fault, no foul. Watch away. And I think that's a dangerous place to be. I'm not sure that's a good thing.
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because I had already written down before you started that both Richard and Andrew had kind of talked about the doctrines being a problem, and I kind of caught on to where you were going when you were talking about, I don't want to jeopardize going to the Celestial Kingdom. This is the safe route to the Celestial Kingdom, and yeah, I can see that there's a doctrinal element to that, but truly we have a deeper version of that doctrine, which is become a this celestial person, become a citizen that would be capable of making the kinds of decisions that gods would be faced with. You know, the beings that you're going to be in sociality with are folks that have internalized truth and paradox and all the different things that this growing up and the agency and responsibility being, you know, two hands of the same coin. Now that's the doctrine of the church, even though there is certainly, you know, sixth grade level stuff that I think you guys were probably focusing on when you said that.
Thanks for saying that. I mean, obviously we're talking generalities in a lot of ways, and certainly there are many members of the church who have completely different viewpoints on art than the Clean Flicks crowd,
right,
or the people who we're talking about. But I do think that for some people, the way they internalize the doctrine results in this sort of immature, if you will, reading of art, where it's decontextualized. Anything that shows nudity or explores like the complexity of like the human condition, whether that it be sexual or with violence or with you know, problems at home, people shy away from that because it's just blanketly bad.
I think there's an underappreciation of film as an art form, definitely within the church. I don't know if that's, you know, extends to the larger world, but I mean, I see film lumped in as the media, and this is the problem with the media. You know, and so they might be able to enjoy a beautiful painting, but you know, a film is a different thing. And it hit me recently. I have a film friend who I work in television with, who's also a painter. He's a fine artist, and he paints nudes, and he doesn't have any problem with that, and he doesn't have any problem with viewing nudes, but he will not watch a movie with nudity in it, and he doesn't even see that as contradictory in any way. And it kind of baffles me to try to understand why that is. He can't understand it within the context of a moving image, and I think that's speaks, you know, to what Andrew was saying about the decontextualization of these things. And you know, I don't think the meaning is in the swear word or in the breast. I mean, you take a film like Hostel, and I watched the Clean Flicks version. I'm too wussy to even watch the R-rated version, but I watched the Clean Flicks version, and it still made me sick to my stomach. The meaning wasn't in those few seconds they cut out of, you know, of the penetration of a blade into a skull or whatever it is they cut out. The meaning is in the, you know, in the entire film still. And so as much as they, you know, still, I'm sure, destroyed that film in many ways as far as the filmmaker was concerned, you can't really take away what that film is saying. And I think they understand that to some degree. I mean, I think they talked about that with in regard to Pretty Woman. You know, they said,
right,
even if we take all the swear words out of Pretty Woman, and it's still a film about a female prostitute. But for some reason, that doesn't carry over into the violence. And I think that's an interesting aspect of American and Mormon culture. This focus on sexuality as evil, but not killing someone. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, people feel guilty about sex. You know, there's all this guilt wrapped up in it. And I think that's definitely inherent to the doctrine. People feel really guilty about anything that's sexual.
So how do you guys handle this? As and I guess I'm saying you guys because I'm kind of the odd man out here, in that I'm not involved in producing art in any real way. But I, you know, it seems like you're part of a culture, or at least have had some experience with a culture that's very good at things like accounting, and you know we have a good business school.
Right.
But in terms of the humanities, you know, there's some real problems in the community, and so then when you go out and you try to produce this art, it seems like it puts you in a very tough position. Maybe you could comment on that personally. I've watched, I guess, you know, more than one artist kind of struggle with trying to find their place in the community and just deciding that there isn't a place.
Well, Richard, I mean, I'm sure you can speak to that. And Neil LaBute talks about that in the film as well. And I could definitely speak to that too, but I'm curious to see what Richard has to say about this.
Yeah, well, it's very strange. It's I found that as an active filmmaker, attending church and being part of a ward or a community, and then going out there too, it's, you know, you'd get such a varied response. You know, some people look at you like you're a general authority, and other people look at you like you're literally like you're, you know, Satan's right-hand man. And so you're constantly in this place where it's like, well, I'm neither one. I'm just a, you know, I'm just a man, and I'm trying to explore some things through my art, you know, and tell some stories because that's what I do. But it was strange, and you go through, you know, baffling times where you just don't understand why people don't get it. I mean, I would have bishops who, you know, I had, you know, some bishops who were very supportive and other bishops who, you know, would basically threaten my temple recommend if I would go out and see the, you know, if I admitted to going out and seeing R-rated films and things like that. So it was such a, you know, it was an uncomfortable situation that I'm glad I don't have to deal with anymore.
For me, it hasn't been too big of a problem, mostly just because I don't think I've ever really fit in to Mormon culture. You know, growing up as an ethnic minority, I really always felt out of place. Also, as an only child and having a single parent, you know, I was always kind of outside what the ideal Mormon was, you know. And then I tried to take control of that as a teenager by having a mohawk and piercing myself and things like that and saying, well, if you're not going to like me, I'm going to control the reasons you don't like me. And now, you know, I feel like, you know, my politics are outside of, you know, at least Utah Mormon culture. You know, I'd be considered a liberal Mormon or an unorthodox Mormon, or I like uncorrelated Mormon myself. But, you know, I just feel like that's kind of my lot in life. And so it's something I embrace, actually, and something that, you know, the people who want to like me will like me. And I also, it helps that that a lot of people in my ward don't really know what I do for a living. but you know, I mean, I talked about, you know, my experiences when I was in the Elders Quorum presidency recently, and I told people, you know, I'm not ever going to make a movie to try to hit a rating. You know, I'm just going to make the best piece of art I can make. And, you know, if it turns out to be, you know, I want to do what's true to the story. I also don't want to throw in a bunch of gratuitous stuff either. You know, it's doing what's best for that piece, and, you know, and whatever that turns out to be is what it will turn out to be.
Yeah, that's well said, man. Well said, Richard and Josh. Well, obviously, like I mentioned, like, I don't consider myself Mormon anymore. Technically, I'm still a member, but I haven't been to church in like 4 or 5 years. And really the tension between...
But you have a family that's pretty LDS.
Oh yeah, my entire family, on both sides. My wife, entire family, my entire family, they're all LDS. So, I mean, I still very much relate to Mormonism on that level. And, you know, we participate in all the different activities that our families participate in as members of the church, and it's totally fine. We get it. We understand it. But one of the reasons why I started to drift away was because of this tension between what's appropriate and not inappropriate, what's appropriate and inappropriate, and sort of feeling like underappreciated or not appreciated or misunderstood, and feeling like desperate to sort of find a place for myself at church and not finding that. And a lot of it had to do with wanting to create challenging art or to talk about things in challenging ways and not just go to church and, you know, talk about Joseph Smith and Emma being in love and, you know, being like the best man the world's ever seen next to Jesus. All these things, I felt sort of uncomfortable. I felt like I didn't belong and people weren't understanding me. And that's really there's a lot more to it than that, but that was part of the reason I drifted away. And I think, like Neil LaBute says in Clean Flicks, you know, here is this guy making these R-rated films, and you've got a church saying, don't watch R-rated films. And, you know, maybe it's more nuanced than that. It's not so black and white. But ultimately, that's one of the reasons he left the church. He felt like he couldn't be a member in good standing and make R-rated films. But like Josh said, you know, I think you can make that work. And I applaud Josh for doing that, but I just couldn't. I felt like I didn't want to be associated with a bunch of people who didn't appreciate me or the things I was trying to do. Even now at family functions, it's like I'm the big joke. I'm the filmmaker. I'm the guy that, like, oh, that's cute. You're making movies. Oh, that's nice. You know, and I mean, I'm making a film right now in Detroit, and I wouldn't live there for 2 years. And I've, like, been filming in some of like the worst neighborhoods in America, making a film about what it's like to be black in a post-industrial society and not have any job opportunities, and like what that means like in America, what it takes to survive. And my entire Mormon family doesn't even see the significance of that, or why it's important to me to tell that story, or why I even care about it. It's like, why don't you just go to church? And like that mindset, like, really just drives me crazy.
Wow, that's powerful.
That is.
Actually, this refers back to something we were talking about earlier, and it was something that when Andrew and Josh interviewed me, it was one thing that, in fact, I lobbied afterwards. I remember talking to Josh and saying, "Hey, did you get that one story in? Did you get that one bit in there?"
Okay, you're going to get it by hell or high water there.
But we were talking about, you know, the talking about whose morality, you know, does my morality trump your morality, and, you know, the different ways people think of things. And, you know, it's just an interesting way of looking at it. You know, we think of going into other people's, you know, into these Hollywood films and removing content that we find offensive. But on, you know, on the other hand, what if, you know, what if there's a group in I don't know, Chicago that decides, you know, they want films to be racier, they want films to be dirtier and edgier. And so, you know, they're going to go in and they're going to take a copy of like The Sound of Music, and they're going to go in and just add a bunch of nudity and some violence, you know, so that, you know, they have a nice, nice song. And then they cut to a couple of lookalikes, you know, silhouetted of Maria and the professor going at it, you know.
Man, the captain, of course. Blowing the whistle.
You present it that way, you know, of course, there's no Latter-day Saint who would agree with that. But in effect, you know, whether you're deleting or adding, you're still, you know, I think it illuminates a certain element of this. You know, it's like you don't have the right to go in and just change it to be more to your liking.
Good. I like that. Yeah. And, you know, that really, maybe one of the areas that we can go back into is this a little bit more about God's laws, human laws. You know, we have this history, you know, this deep history of occasionally fudging or lying for the Lord, or there's deep cultural roots for sort of thinking our morality is different. And did we cover that enough, or does anyone have anything left that they want to really kind of jump in with?
Well, when we were making the film, I mean, I remember the day it occurred to Andrew and I that, you know, this kind of reminded us of the post-manifesto polygamy in a way. You know, there was the government coming in and saying you can't do this, but, you know, behind the scenes there were a lot of people moving and shaking to keep it going because they believed what they were doing was the right thing to do. Right. And they believed that what they were doing was more in line with what God, you know, had intended for them. And and we talked to David Knowlton about that a little bit, and I think, you know, there is a history of that in the church, this idea that God's law is higher than man's law.
I kind of feel like the God's law versus man's law argument, it maybe could be a red herring, and that actually, like, people who are soliciting clean flicks really just didn't want to feel guilty about it, about watching R-rated movies.
I think so.
Yeah, it could be, yeah.
It's kind of like going to Vegas and getting married for the weekend. Not as extreme, but same principle, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What's, you know, you guys all came into the podcast probably, you know, having some points that you definitely wanted to make. Is there anything that was not really covered? I think this is really, I've been thrilled with the discussion. So thank you.
I'd love to throw one more out there if you'll let me, Dan.
Please.
Here, and this is, I'm being completely sincere about this. I still attend church fairly regularly. I have distanced myself somewhat, but I go. And here's the question, and I want to tie this into clean flicks and just this sense of spirituality in film and art. You know, why is it that I can go to Sunday school and I am just completely, you know, I'll even make an effort. And I'm just completely bored out of my mind, and I very rarely will get anything out, really, of those lessons. But yet I can go see a movie like The Descendants that just came out, a great movie, and I can come out of there more spiritually uplifted. I just saw the movie the other day, having learned something, I think, in about relationships, about grieving, about forgiveness. Really a powerful movie, but yet I'll mention that to other members of the church, and you know, one F word, and it just makes it so they can't get anything out of something that I have found to be a pretty valuable experience. Is it possible that Clean Flicks is serving a purpose in a sense by removing some of those, I'll admit it, dumb roadblocks, but sure, take out some F words, and then maybe some of this art will actually get through into the church and change some people? I mean, does it still carry some power in that way? Would any of you defend Clean Flicks from that perspective?
Well, I want to first point out that the irony that, you know, we're grown men here and we're still using the term the F word.
Thank you, sir.
It was just, you know, pure consideration for the audience.
No, that's a great point. You know, in other words, a Clean Flicks version of Schindler's List could still move and teach.
You know, is it better that they see the Clean Flicks version or no version at all?
Right,
you know?
I'm certain.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think they asked a lot of the filmmakers that in the heyday, you know, and honestly, a lot of the filmmakers came down on the side of, I'd rather, I mean, I know Steven Soderbergh talked about this with Traffic, so I'd rather they not watch my film at all if they don't want to watch it in this way. And I don't know if that's pride on his part or if he's really saying that, you know, he doesn't feel you can get the message without those certain images. I mean, I think what we've done with Clean Flicks shows that we would still like to have that conversation exist, even if people aren't necessarily willing to watch the more offensive content. But I mean, I think it's a good question. And I think, you know, it was also one that Steven Spielberg addressed when he made Schindler's List. He would not allow that film to be edited for airlines or television. In fact, it ran on television unedited. He also, there was a theater in Utah that was open to children under the age of 17 to go and watch Schindler's List, despite it being rated R. Tickets have been paid for in advance, and anyone could go watch it if you were under the age of 18 at this theater. And I think it's something that filmmakers probably struggle with a lot, but I think you're probably right. I think overall, I think it probably would benefit people to get a taste of it rather than none.
I always argued that people, you know, the one thing that no one ever seemed to bring up was, and I would argue, you know, if Mormons aren't satisfied with the product that's made available, they should be making their own. You know, if these values are so important to them, and if they, you know, if they wanted to watch film, then they should be more active in producing the kind of films that they wanted to see. And that takes, right, that takes me to a, you know, what I think illustrates my point earlier about, you know, kind of the lack of sophistication and maturity in the arts is, you know, I mean, anybody who's been active in the church for any period of time whatsoever, when you see a lot of the, you know, whether it's the film that's in the temple as part of the endowment ceremony, or whether it's, you know, some, you see such a remedial level of filmmaking that it's actually kind of shocking. So,
but I wonder, like, let's take The Descendants for as an example, Brent, since you brought it up. It's, you know, I saw it in theaters here at the Broadway in downtown Salt Lake. It's a good film. And I wonder if the power of the film is in some of that content that would get excised if Clean Flicks were to clean it up. The way that he reacts to the news of his wife having cheated on him prior to her sickness, the final scene where he breaks down with her, like, in the hospital. Like, there's tons of material that would have had to have been edited out for a Clean Flicks audience. And I wonder if the power and the nuance of that film is actually in the material that would have been excised, because it makes the humans fallible, it makes them more interesting, and all of that content, which is, you know, when it's decontextualized, is considered bad, is what gives life to that film and to those characters and to that story. It makes them real. It makes them people you can relate to. And when you pull all that stuff out, what you get are caricatures of human beings. Everybody swears, everybody makes mistakes, and when you don't represent that material in a film, you're getting material that is not true to life.
Well, and I'm sure Alexander Payne is smart enough to have made that. He probably could have made that film without that material in that, but when you pull that out of an existing film, I think is where you start to see the problems. Richard talks about that in the film. You know, a filmmaker makes a film like an architect builds a building, and so although maybe you could make a great film that would have all that you know, those same emotional beats and all of that same content without some of the more offensive content. When you pull that out of a film that's already exists, it does start to kind of fall apart. And I think Andrew's probably right. It probably does lose something integral to the integrity of the film.
Integral to the integrity. Love it.
Yeah.
That's my kind of statement. Cool. Love it, man.
So Andrew, and I agree with you here, but I think a lot of Mormons would find this to be a fairly difficult assertion to defend. This idea that those rough parts of that film are not only valuable, but they carry some of the weight, some of what I call the spiritual lessons from the Descendants are in those rough portions of the mm-hmm. film.
Oh, wow.
And so the idea that you can actually get something, that you can learn something about humanity and about grace and about forgiveness, you know, by someone swearing, seems to be a pretty foreign idea to a lot of, I would argue, a lot of how Mormons see the world.
I completely agree. I feel like it is hard for them, and I don't know how you convince someone to look beyond their own personal values and appreciate how that experience is affecting that character in that story, and not to, like, you know, project your own insecurities about swearing or your own guilt about hearing the F-bomb onto this film that you're watching. I don't know how you get past that, and I agree that it's a hard argument to make to an LDS audience, but I think that, you know, I stand behind the idea that content, I mean, at least in this specific example, like, adds to the depth of the experience when you engage with the material of the film.
I want to throw something on this. It's been so long since I've had these conversations that it's taking a while for my brain to get back into this. but I do, what I remember making the point, you know, the fact that, you know, it seemed odd to me that Mormons would have a problem with a lot of the content, whether it's violence or the violence or the sexuality, when, they're scriptural stories themselves that are the basis for their religion, you know, especially, I mean, if you go into the Old Testament or the Book of Mormon or basically, you know, any of the scriptures, you know, it's filled with violence and sex. And you know, the scriptures themselves would be, you know, the scriptures themselves would be rated R. And so I find it interesting that we're able to completely ignore that part of the argument.
Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I hate to quote Brigham Young, because you can find a, as we all know, you can find a Brigham Young quote to kind of back up any point you want to make. But right. you know, there was a theater built in the early days of the church being in the Salt Lake Valley, and, you know, Brigham Young was asked about the validity of having a theater there that would show, you know, that was showing things that were dark in the human character. And I'm paraphrasing him, but he basically said that there's a lot of value in that, and that it's important to see those dark times, you know, those dark moments in the soul, so that we know where we don't want to end up, and that theater is actually providing a service by showing us those things. That certainly is not something that has survived in the culture from that time.
Yeah, very interesting.
But I think it's an important aspect of art that LDS artists need to take seriously if they want to be taken seriously as artists. I was at a Utah Arts conference at Sundance about a year ago. And, you know, there's people like James Christensen and Janice Kat Perry are there. And they're certainly, I mean, I don't know, Janice Kat Perry is not known for pushing the envelope necessarily. But, you know, so it's not all that all art, you know, needs to ask tough questions. But I think there's certainly a space. And I think one of the important callings of an artist is to ask hard questions of one's community. And that's, you know, that's kind of the calling that I feel, if you could call it that.
Very cool.
It's got to be tough when you hit that wall, though. I mean, I'm just trying to kind of, it seems like it would be so much harder to actually produce this art and have it be summarily rejected because it's got three F words in it. You know, I have a hard enough time. The last movie I recommended to what I would call a conservative member of the church was Spanglish. Was a movie I really liked, and you know, you just hit a wall there. I remember they looked at it, they watched, you know, 10 minutes of it, and then right. you know, thought it was right. filth because it right. you know, dealt with semi-adultery.
Infidelity.
You know, it yeah. wasn't even adultery. you know, it was just a complicated human condition. So, you know, it's got to be frustrating for y'all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We need more grown-ups in the world. Well, yay.
that's why I'm not making any more Mormon movies.
Yeah, interesting. Hey, you guys, thank you for this great discussion. I'm going to wrap it up here, if that's all right with you. But I want to give especially you three filmmakers a chance to plug projects. And again, Josh and Andrew, tell us again how to order the DVD. But also tell us those other films that you're working on if you want to. And Richard, remind us about Falling and all that good stuff. And then we'll head on out of here.
Clean Flicks is available now via iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, Video on Demand, on television throughout the United States and Canada. But the DVD does come out this week. You can get it at our website, CleanFlicks with an X, themovie.com. That's just CleanFlicksthemovie.com. And the great selling point of that is there is a clean version. You can show your Mormon friends and family, so you can have these discussions with them. Currently, I'm working on kind of my dream project, something that I've been wanting to do my entire life, ever since I first heard about Mark Hoffman when I was a young lad. My grandfather bought the book Salamander, and he read it to me, and we discussed it for hours on end. And I'm doing a documentary, and I have a script for a feature for the Mark Hoffman story, and I'm really excited about that. And we're shooting the documentary right now, and hope to have that completed by the fall.
Awesome. That's great. I hadn't heard about that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, cool. Sounds awesome.
So, Andrew, you've talked a little bit about your Detroit film. Is there, you want to tell more about that or anything else that you're working on?
Yeah, so right after Clean Flicks, I started working on a film in Detroit. It's called Street Fighting Man, and it's about three men in Detroit, each a generation apart, struggling to survive in post-industrial America. And it's a young man who's selling drugs, trying to get off the streets, a middle-aged man who was homeless and bought a crack house, a former crack house, for $1,500 and is trying to fix it up and find a place to live. And then also a 60-year-old retired police officer who is the de facto sheriff of his neighborhood since the police station closed down, and patrols his community with a shotgun and a video camera.
Wow.
And it's these three stories interwoven to paint a portrait of post-industrial life, what happens when industry leaves and communities are left to figure it out for themselves with no social, with no public services and collapsing infrastructure. And so that's the backdrop of these three stories. It's a character-driven film about these three guys, and I lived there for a year, but traveled back and forth for 2 years and just observed these guys in that space and just embedded myself in their lives and became a fixture in that community. And we're in editing mode right now and hoping the film will be done by the fall. And you can see the trailer and check out the film at streetfightingmanthemovie.com. And we'll be launching a Kickstarter campaign, actually, a second one, to raise some additional funds for post here probably this week. So
we're going to post this on the 17th. An active discussion will probably get going on the blog about this and the different themes of this podcast. So definitely, you know, point us towards that Kickstarter campaign, Andrew, when the time comes.
Sure.
Yeah, I think a lot of people want to help. Richard, what you got going, brother? Well, you kind of talked about it, but remind us about it or plug anything else, too.
Oh, no. Yeah, I've got a lot going on, but I think I just want to focus on my film Falling, which is probably, in a lot of ways, my favorite of all the films that I've made, and the most personal of all the films that I've made. And also, I guess it's turned out to be the most critically successful. So I guess the most critically successful and so far the most commercially unsuccessful film that I've made. So definitely want to give that a plug, because I have one more chance to make the film work and hopefully get it out into some other cities, depending on how good our Salt Lake audience is and Salt Lake box office. So it opens Friday the 27th of April. We have a big premiere that night at 7 o'clock there at the Broadway. We're going to have some of the stars of the film out, and I'll do a Q&A afterwards. And anyway, I've often referred to it as the first R-rated Mormon film, but I guess Josh and Andrew now have an R-rated Mormon film too. So.
Ours is actually unrated, so you're okay. You beat us.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's awesome, man. I'm gonna try to make it.
It's a really powerful film. It's a really powerful film. I think for an LDS audience, it really still speaks to the LDS community. I think, and you know, here's a film for you, Brent, that actually speaks directly to a Mormon audience, but deals with some really heavy subject matter and has some content that some might find offensive.
Yeah, it's a difficult film, but it's definitely got a huge payoff. So anybody who's within shouting distance of Salt Lake City, please attend between the 27th and what would it be, just the first week of May, because that's really what's going to determine whether the Broadway keeps it there for a few more weeks, right, Richard? As these are going to be the numbers that you're going to be able to show other regions of the country. This is what it did in Salt Lake and try to.
Is there a website, Richard?
Yeah, actually the website just crashed on us, so we're working on getting that back up. But it's fallingmovie.com, and you can also go to mainstreetmovieco.com.
Okay.
And I believe you can actually, if you go to richarddutcher.com, I think there's some stuff there as well. So,
cool.
But yeah, I'd love to see that do well, and so we could get it out to places like Texas and Maryland and all the art houses across the country. It all just depends on how well it does at the box office.
Very good. So even, yeah, just do it as a favor to art in general and as thanks to Richard or whatever it is. Just it really matters. Even one or two extra people can make a huge difference and come into that. So
yeah.
Hey, well, everybody, it's been a fantastic discussion. Thank you so much. We'll get this up on the 17th. Listeners, please blog. Send us the comments there at the MormonMatters.org comment page. Share your story. Share your thoughts. Tell us what you think's going on in the culture or take these guys on and any of their opinions, and I'll encourage them to come to the blog and fight back with you. So that'll be great. While you're there, feel free, please, more than feel free, to donate to MormonMatters.org. It really makes a big difference in my family's life. So thanks for much for those of you who have already subscribed and for those who pushed the donate button. So, guys, any final words?
No, thanks, man. It was great.
Thanks so much, Dan. It was
good night, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for all your support. Thanks, Brent. Nice to meet you.
Thanks, you guys.
Yeah,
thanks for putting
great.
Up with an outsider.
No, it was awesome. Oh, it was great.
Okay, great to have you, and I'll just wish you guys good night.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.